follow that, but primarily pointing out particular things that you might find of interest, that explain a little bit about the university and some of the challenges it faces. But I'd like to begin by pointing out that next December, Ann and I will pass our 50th year point at the university. That, I believe, is the longest tenure for any Michigan president, not in the role of president, but in the role of service to the university. Doesn't match Marilyn Mason or Carl Cohen, but we're not through yet. We arrived in Ann Arbor in December 1968, the same week as Bo Schembechler arrived. And we moved into Northwood 4, graduate student housing, because at that time, young faculty weren't paid enough to buy a house. And so the university kind of took a number of us. Some of us, some of our friends are still around. The question as to why we decided to move from sunny Pasadena in December to cold, cold Ann Arbor is a question you're going to have to ask Ann. You know, the Bicentennial provides an opportunity to explore Michigan history. I've always found it interesting the stress that private universities, particularly the Ivies, place on history, and the fact that public universities, they tend to come back to their history on moments like a centennial and a sesquicentennial, and to celebrate it at that point, but then they kind of leave it behind. Actually, though, I think I would include the 1990s as a time when history was important again. And I don't want to embarrass her, but I have to look at Ann for that reason. You know, in our roles, in dean, provost, and president, these were two-person roles. These were partnerships. That's the way that things used to work, and they continue to work at some time, although sometimes Ann and I worry that she's the last First Lady. but part of her interests as we went through the provost and into the presidency was the history of the university. And she worked with people like Bob Warner, who had returned from being the head of the National Archives, and began to pull me into it, first at the provost level, when a decision was made to essentially give the Bentley Library the responsibility to archive and promote the university's history, because I put $500,000 a year into their budget permanently and said, you do it. Peg and Nick Stenick were teaching a wonderful lecture course on the university's history in LSNA, but LSNA wasn't too interested in supporting it, so we agreed to pick it up in the provost office. As we moved into the presidency, Ann became much more involved. She created a history and traditions committee that met throughout the 1990s. We created the position of persuaded the university to create the position of university historian that Bob Warner filled. She, as you know, was very active in renovating and actually saving many of the historic facilities in Michigan, the Detroit Observatory, the President's House, of course, and Inglis House. She also, at the time, was beginning to collect a lot of information. When we left the presidency, she did a marvelous book of photographs that she had obtained from the Bentley Library, a photographic saga of the university. She launched a faculty history project to document all of those faculty going back to the founding of the university who had served the university, essentially picking up everybody after they had retired or left the university, a number of about 20,000 now, invited faculty to contribute their memoirs and so forth, and did a very complete documentation of the university, its academic units, their histories, and so forth. And all of that has been captured on a website. I passed some of the website addresses out over here, but I'll kind of circulate these around for those of you who don't have them yet. And I would strongly encourage you to start roaming through them. There's a tremendous amount of information in it, and there's a lot of fun stuff. The one that I like is the one, it's a video of the Michigan locker room following the Rose Bowl win over USC, in which Bo Schembechler leads me, the governor, and the Michigan Wolverines in hail to the victors. So there's a lot of fun stuff. But anyway, that kind of provided, I think, important materials for the university's history, but it also got me very interested in it. And that's where I learned much of what I'm going to talk about this evening. Let me go through a few points. We are celebrating a bicentennial that dates, if you subtract 200 years, to 1817. Actually, on August 26, 1817, Michigan was not a state. It was part of the Northwest Territory, so it's the Michigan Territory. And the territorial government, which was essentially a federal organization, led by Augustus Woodward, passed an act on August 26, 1817, that created what Woodward called the Catholicistodiad, or University of Michigania. Now, Woodward's idea of a university was adopted from Napoleon's Imperial University of France. Okay, Napoleon had, you know, essentially destroyed the French colleges and universities and created this thing, which was had some parts of a university, but it was just as much primary, secondary schools, libraries, botanical gardens, things like this. And so that's what was created. It wasn't really a simply a university. It essentially first manifested itself in a small primary school in Detroit. And eventually, in the 1820s, that primary school, because it only had one teacher, disappeared for a few years and then reappeared. But the reality was that what we think of as the University of Michigan as our definition of university did not arrive until the university moved to Ann Arbor. And the first student arrived at the university in 1841. As Ann pointed out to me, there were no students in the Michigan Territory through those early years. However, if August 26, 1817, which was when the act was passed, is the birthday of the university, I find it kind of puzzling because I went over to the Diag and walked around with a camera and couldn't see anything that recognized the birthday. I saw a lot of students checking in. There was a large motorcycle gang that had taken over the steps of Angel Hall. But so I wonder if people kind of forget things like that. Well, anyway, there's an important story of the battle between the regents and alumni over whether Michigan was really created in 1817, which is what the alumni wanted, or was created in 1837 when it moved to Ann Arbor, which is what the regents wanted. The Michigan Supreme Court finally weighed in and decided it shall be 1817, so that's what we have today. Okay, so that's point one. Michigan was established as a territorial institution, not as a state institution, okay? And you can make the case, and the regents from time to time in their early years made this case, that Michigan is as much a federal university as it is a state university. And that was particularly the case because the state really provided no funds for the institution until after the Civil War. So point number one. Point number two. That's where people from Ann Arbor stepped forward, offered a 40-acre site, which we now call the Diag, to actually build the university. Of course, as I said, it was not yet a university. The four houses were built on the around the quad, the 40 acres, and then finally they got through federal land grants and or state land grants the money to build University Hall, which was the first large building. But the next point I'd like to come to is how the first Michigan Constitution treated the university. In that Constitution, which was 1851, the Michigan legislature, and of course Michigan had come into the Union in 1837, decided to give the University of Michigan autonomy in the Constitution. Now, apparently, if you read books about the history, it was because, in part, Michigan still had a very frontier population, and they were very nervous about government. And so They gave Michigan constitutional autonomy. It's very unusual. There's only one other institution in the country I'm aware of that has it, and I'll explain that in just a moment. But that constitutional autonomy protects this university from invasive treatment by the state and so forth. The university has been very fortunate and I think very strategic in establishing that through the judicial process. So periodically, they sue the state, and they usually sue the state on a violation of constitutional autonomy they think they can win. During my years, the state legislature decided to go after us on the issue of same-sex benefits, paying attention to the needs of the gay community. And we ever so politely threatened to sue them and back them away, and it reestablished the autonomy. The second thing they did was to create a board of regents which would be elected by the public. And Sandy White, whose daughter Kathy is a regent like that and has entered third term as regent, becomes a regent through public election, and that's unusual. But then they took one final step, is that they defined the position of a president of the university that would chair the board of regent meetings without vote. And so, in a sense, the president can set the agenda and kind of shape the discussion, but the regents have the authority. I mentioned there was one other institution that had constitutional autonomy. It's the University of California. It was not created until after the Civil War by the Morrell Act. At that time, California was an agricultural state, and when they created the University of California, they were very worried that the farmers would dominate the California Assembly and force the university to become an agricultural school. So they waited till spring planting season. They copied the language verbatim from the Michigan Constitution, and they passed it in the California Assembly before the farmer votes came back.
Was that when Berkeley was the only campus?
Mm-hmm. They took a small school in Berkeley. There was a farm in Davis, but Berkeley was the establishment. Constitutional autonomy. That's important because I believe it's the first reason why Michigan has become and remains a great university. Certainly not because of state support. Third, the search for the president. They hired, after Broad's search, the regents hired Henry Tappan, a former professor of philosophy at NYUN. Mm-hmm. Tappan was very familiar with what was happening in Europe at the time, particularly in Prussia, in German universities. And in which, rather than adopt the Harvard-Yale model, which was essentially a British boys' school, taking young students at the age of 16, teaching them Greek, Latin, and then turning them loose on the world, to add scholarship, research to the role of the university. The leader of education in Prussia at the time, Wilhelm Humboldt, essentially established the model in Prussia of what we call the research university today. That was what Tappan tried to build in Ann Arbor as he came to lead the University of Michigan. And you can make the case that the University of Michigan was not only the first public university in America. The other three universities that preceded it in the States were South Carolina, Georgia, and North Carolina, and we'll think Chapel Hill, okay? Michigan was a public university. But then second, it was really the first true university in America, the first university that accepted the broad balance between learning and scholarship. As a result, it's provided leadership for higher education throughout its history. Fran Bluen, former head of the Bentley, one time made the statement that almost every advance in higher education during its first century in this country has Michigan's fingerprints on it. In one of the books Ann and I wrote, we tried to make a list of Michigan firsts, and single space, it took 6 pages. Okay, well, that's the second big thing. Constitutional autonomy, the first true university in America. let's move, kind of fast forward and finish the history by moving to the Duderstadt years. We're leaving a lot behind, but that's what we remember. During the 50 years since we've been here, state support has declined, declined, declined. I used to get in trouble by the regents when I used to say that in my years at Michigan, the university has evolved from a state supported to a state assisted, to a state related, to a state located, to only a state molested institution. When we arrived here in 1968, 70% of the academic support of the university was state by the state. Today, it's only 7% of our academic support, and of our total resources, it's only about 3%. So, how did we manage? How did we become what one of our former provosts and then wonderful president of Cornell, Frank Rhodes, put it, how did we become a publicly committed but privately supported university? That was during the 1990s. It involves a very clever chief financial officer, Ferris Womack, that we raided from the University of North Carolina. And he found out that scattered across the university, our deans and directors had stashed away funds that may have been left over from other projects, or they were keeping in reserve, saving up to go for a new building or something like that. And unfortunately, they were investing those funds in the National Bank of Detroit for the standard interest that you get by putting it in your savings account. So what Ferris did is he told them that he would start a bank, and he would get people that really knew how to manage money, people like Al Talman and some others, to advise him. And he would, if they would invest their money, he would invest it as if it were an endowment. They would hire some professional people to do it and so forth. And what he did in the decade he was here is he took an endowment of $200 million to an endowment of $3 billion. Most of which did not come from gifts to the university, but came from managing the resources of the university. That endowment today is worth almost $10 billion, maybe $10 billion now, with the growth of over the last several months. It ranks sixth in the nation. It generates, on the order of 4.5% a year is what the payout is, so it would generate $450 million a year. Our state support was never much more than $300 million. So it essentially replaced state support, but it did something else. Because the university was so unique as a public university in creating this endowment, in the 1990s, Wall Street smiled on us and gave us the highest possible credit rating that you can get at Wall Street, a AAA credit rating. The only other university that has it and had it after us was the University of Texas, and that's because of all their oil money. So what that meant is that when we go out and build a building, we may get a pledge of $100 million to build a building. But what we do is we borrow the money at the cheapest possible rate, probably about 2% today. Then, because we're a public institution, we can invest that money while the construction is underway. That's called arbitraging, if you're into it. And so that's kind of the secret. We are, as I say, very much a public university, but if you look at our numbers, over 90% of the public that pays for us doesn't live in Michigan, okay? Although we are very supportive of the state. So that's the second thing. While we're talking about the last point yesterday, let me mention two other things. Today, particularly in the last several days, compelling importance of what is called today diversity, equity, and inclusion has dominated concerns of this campus and much of higher education. That was also the case in the 1980s and 1990s when I was provost and then president. We launched an effort at that time called the Michigan Mandate, and in terms of measurable qualities, actually got African-American enrollment up to almost 10%. It was 9.7%. When I stepped down as president, half of my executive officers were African-American, including Rita Dumas, who I had just appointed as executive vice president for the medical center. Since she was a nurse, the doctors didn't like that very much. I thought that symbolically, Rita was an outstanding leader. We followed that with the Michigan Agenda for Women. Edie Goldenberg was our first woman dean of LSNA. As I say, Rita was our first senior executive officer. And of course, although it was after my leadership and due to the wisdom of the regents, Mary Sue Coleman was the first woman president of the university. On these efforts, particularly the Michigan Mandate, we were identified as one of the leading universities in the country. Since that time, a number of things happened. There was a constitutional amendment to the state constitution banning affirmative action, although that never was really a part of how we put together the Michigan Mandate. But there are other reasons for that, and we've now got to rebuild that. What about sports? After the basketball scandal today, I'll only just make a couple of comments. 5 Rose Bowls, a record against Ohio State of 8-1-1, NCAA championships in hockey, and the Fab Five in basketball. suffer from. Okay, that's enough. Okay, Michigan today. Again, most people don't realize it, but the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, is the largest university campus in the world. Okay, others have more students than we do. The University of Texas has 50,000 students. We have about 45,000. But the budget this year is about $7.8 billion for this university. Our facilities, 35 million square feet, the largest of any university in the world. Our research activity, 140 million a year, first in the nation, and it has been for the last 20 years. In complexity, we have almost every discipline except agriculture, and somewhere I'm sure we've got it. I don't know where it is, maybe the botanical garden. Michigan changes the world from time to time. During my years as provost and then president, we essentially built the internet for the country. And we followed on that with what's called the HathiTrust. That's the world's largest digital library. It's got about 15 million volumes now. And I might also add that that was in part the birthplace of Google, because Larry Page was involved with that when he was a student here very early in its incarnation. So it's a very big place. It is very broad. And it's very complex. Okay, now the next point. How do you manage a place like this? How do you lead it? Well, you can't lead it top down. Michigan is an ecosystem. Okay, it adapts and evolves to respond to its environment. Think of it like a rainforest. Okay, it draws its strength from its roots, from people, from faculty, from students, from staff, not from its branches high up. They wither and die. Okay? It's from the roots. It's an ecosystem. It's always changing. It's remarkably effective at repelling invasive species. And I always like to use the example of an athletic director who lived in a house just a few doors down that when first arrived in that position, he said, "My motto is, if it ain't broken, break it." Lasted 2 years. Yep. 3 years. The 3 years that I always tell people at the University of Michigan who come here for the first time, there are 3 years, 3 rules, not 3 years, there are 3 rules for thriving at Michigan that we've learned over our 50 years. Rule number one is you never take no for an answer. If you ask enough people, someone will surely eventually say yes. New rule number 2, the most important play in the Michigan playbook is the end run. Okay, if a faculty member is blocked by the chair, you go to the dean. If a dean is having problems with the provost, you go to the president. or maybe you go to the Regents, or maybe you go to Lansing, okay? We work through the in-run, that's this kind of ecosystem. And rule number three is to realize it's far more effective to seek forgiveness than to ask permission. And so, Ann can tell you, as provost and dean and provost and president, I ask forgiveness many, many times. Okay, now, let me kind of move to tomorrow, and then we can discuss some of these. On November 15th, I am chairing a major national convocation at the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine at National Academy Headquarters with the title Strengthening the Partnership That Built America. And what we're talking about is how to build a partnership between universities, the federal government, the states, and the business sector, industry, that created modern agriculture and industry in the 19th century, that won the Cold War in the 20th century, and yet is very much being challenged right now. We originally had decided to host this convocation and start planning it on November 14th last year. I was to chair that meeting, and I arrived, and that meeting was, as you may recall, 1 week after the election results. And everyone was, you know, just couldn't even talk. So we delayed the meeting a year, and it's going to happen in November. The issues that surround it, we think, are five in number. First, demographics. Although the pace of growth of the global population is slowing, it's highly varied. For example, Africa will see a 2 billion person growth in its population over the next 30 years. Most developed nations, Europe, China, and so forth, will see declining populations as their populations age. But the United States is different for one important reason: immigration. We are a nation of immigrants. For the last 20 years, our population has grown more from immigration than from childbirth. Okay? That's why the political discussions and so forth involving immigration are absolutely critical to the future of this country. And so that's an issue that faces it. But there's one more trend in demographics. Today's millennial generation, and that's kind of college age people, I don't remember the right, I think it's 18 to some 30-something. Today's millennial have a 50-50 chance to live into their 90s. There's a book just published by a couple of Brits called The 100-Year Life, because a child born today in a developed nation like the United States has a 50-50 chance of living into their hundreds. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the implication of that? No country can afford for these people to retire at the age of 70 or 80. What it means is for these generations, they're going to have to continue to work well into their later years, which will not be later years. And since if you're going to try and have a job in your 80s, what you learn in your 20s is probably not going to be very relevant anymore. We've got to figure out a way to provide lifelong learning. So that's a huge challenge for universities and indeed our educational system. Okay, so how to keep these people, not only they're going to be healthy, but they've got to have the skills to work. Second, technology, obviously. To show my age, the year I was born is the year that ENIAC, the first electronic computer, went into operation and had the processing power of the chip that plays Jingle Bells when you open a Christmas card. Although it helped design the hydrogen bomb. That's another story. Over my five-decade-long career, this technology, computers and everything about it, has increased in power 1,000-fold a decade. For the last several years, I've led a major Department of Energy study that is not a study. We're using the world's fastest computers to design the next generation of nuclear power. And we will get delivery next year of the fastest computer in the world, and it can do 10 followed by 18 zeros a second worth of arithmetic calculations. And then a decade later, it's 10 followed by 21 zeros. Okay, so it's hard to fathom. The Swiss call this the fourth industrial revolution because it will have an immense impact. We have a daughter that's a granddaughter at Oberlin College that's studying history, and her schedule this fall is she's taking a general history course, a course on the Muslim religion, a couple of other things, and then a course on data management and deep learning. Now, what's that have to do with history? Well, that's artificial intelligence, okay? And that's what these kids are learning. Third, creativity and convergence. Most wealth in the 20th century was created through analyzing what is, lawyers, business people, and so on. Wealth in the 21st century will be derived from creating what has not been. Where you can build materials atom by atom. The building that is named after Ann and me on the North Campus is very heavily involved in 3D printing. In fact, we're printing implantable organs that can be put in patients, babies that have a trachea that is malformed or so forth using 3D printing. And most scary of all, about 4 years ago, something called CRISPR-Cas9. Which is human gene editing came along, where we now have the capacity to edit with very high accuracy part of the DNA strand that controls human life. So these tools of creativity are becoming very powerful. They're beginning to merge physical knowledge, biological knowledge, social sciences. They're all coming together. So how do universities teach people to be creative? Well, on the North Campus, we have a very unusual constellation of four schools, art, architecture, music, and engineering, that all are built around the intellectual process of creating things, not studying things of the past, but creating things to serve society or entertain society that are new. The problem was that those schools really didn't interact very much with each other. So in the 1990s, thanks to many trips that my colleague Dan Atkins and I made to Lansing to beg for money. We got $75 million out of it. The deans came up with the idea of the media union as a place where all of these disciplines, the students could come together and work together to create together. It's now called, thanks to the Regents, the James and Ann Duderstadt Center. But the theme is, again, to tap what the deans called the Renaissance Campus, these four schools, and get artists working with musicians for performance, working with engineers, and so forth. The fourth theme, social and political challenge. Social network, Twitter. I hear Twitter is now going to double the amount that you're going to have to write down and wear out Trump's alt-truth attacks on science. That's the National Academy meeting I'm going to have in November. What to do about it? That's a big change. And as one of the 97% of scientists that are a climate change believer, not denier, that's quite a challenge. Incidentally, I might say, with climate change, aside thing, one of our daughters is an atmospheric scientist at the University of New Hampshire. And she's running a series of seminars this year. The first one was given by Henry Pollack from Michigan, over what's going to happen to the northeast of the United States, the New England area, as the Arctic sea ice melts. Well, the first thing is that Boston is going to become the principal export hub for China, because you just go up and over the pole, okay? Think what that's going to do. I mean, our nearest neighbors will be China and Russia, not Europe, okay? Because you don't go across the Atlantic Pacific, you go over. That's climate change. Climate challenge. And that's the future itself. As I mentioned, climate change is real. And when it's 106 degrees in San Francisco, you know something's happening. We're seeing widening gaps in prosperity, health, and quality of life that's infected our political system. What scientists call singularities. Artificial intelligence was not really a very productive area until about 10 years ago when they decided, well, computers are fast enough, why don't we just let them learn on their own rather than telling them how to think? That's called machine learning. But what happens if the machine learns enough to become conscious? Well, there are a lot of people that think that might happen. There are other things. You know, every once in a while I read in the paper of an asteroid that's that, you know, kind of just missed the Earth and someone just saw it. I had thought that nuclear warfare was something of the past, but it may not be. But that kind of is the final challenge for universities, because we've got to prepare our students to develop the skills, to develop the knowledge and the values to face such possibilities. And to make sure either they don't happen or to make certain that our world continues to survive and prosper. Okay. So that's yesterday, today, and a little bit tomorrow. And we have a few minutes for questions, if anyone wants to ask questions. If not, I should say, on the website on that card, there are about 40 books that Ann and I have written that are all downloadable, okay?
Wow.
You don't have to read them. What you do is you download them, and then you put them on your email, and you send it to Kindle, and it goes on your iPod, iPad, and you can read it. Okay. And so the future of the university and all this other stuff. Yes?
And how much do they cost?
Pardon? They're free. Everything we publish is Creative Commons. They're all on HathiTrust as well, but they're all free. And a lot of them are course notes, because I don't like to make students buy books, so I write books for them.
When Paul Courant talked with us, he explained this. So if any of you who were there for that chat, you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
So this isn't a question per se, but it was a fact that I learned when I was in graduate school, because I was in graduate school in 67 here. And the professor said, do you know why we're having a sesquicentennial? Not a centennial. And of course, his answer was because in 1937, by that time they had decided that 1817 was the founding date of the university.
Yeah, that's right.
His fact, again, quote, was that Michigan got tired of standing behind all the other schools at inaugurations of presidents and so they wanted to move ahead.
Yeah. Well, no, that's a good idea. That makes sense. That sounds like the Michigan tradition. There probably were a couple of Michigan judges on the Supreme Court that ruled that way.
I have one question about related to science. Engineering school, I'm sure they work so hard to develop the robot.
Yeah.
Talking about robot. But as you said, you're going to increase population 150% until 100 years, whatever. Then what are going to be? We don't need any labor, everything running by the robot. Then do you think about the other part? Mm-hmm. Work for, we don't have, they don't need many human working. And for example, the medicine, they work, my husband is a physician, so he's concerning also about robot is trying to cure the human disease.
Right.
And then what happens they don't need many doctors, nurses. So do they thinking about what's coming up in the future, the other part?
Yeah, we have a young family who's, the father is a pediatric anesthesiologist, and we were trying to think, what's medicine going to be in the future? And he said, I'll tell you what my job will be in the future. I will sit with the patient, and I will first explain the diagnosis that's just been given to me by the artificial intelligence that's analyzed all the data. And then second, I will explain to the patient what the robot surgeon is going to do to fix. I think you really, I tend to be more optimistic. First of all, I think that machine consciousness is way downstream, okay? And the human brain is strange enough that it may not be replicated. But I also look back when the first power looms began to replace the weaving industry. There were people that were put out of work, but that created important tools for people that had new skills. And I think many people believe that the kind of technology, at least in the near term, will amplify human capacity if provided with enough education. Way over the horizon, we don't know. But if it does happen, it's probably out there already. So maybe they'll contact us. But as I say, I think for it will force education to play a much more significant role, which is a challenge to educational institutions. But I think that it will, if done properly, will improve the quality of human life rather than threaten human employment and so forth. Yes?
So one of the things that I always think about is following the money, where what's the underpinnings. And I go back to Bernie Sanders and his talk about how colleges and universities were so unaffordable to so many of our own students here. I wonder what you're thinking about that is with reference to the University of Michigan. Will it become more elitist and community colleges will fill the role mm-hmm. that Bernie Sanders has talked about to make some college affordable?
It's difficult. As I said, Michigan tries very much to be a public institution, but we have lost most of our public support, at least from the state as a sponsor. And in fact, most of higher education since the turn of the century has lost, institutions like Michigan have lost about 35% of their state support in the average. So in part, we've had to shift from the tax dollars that people were willing to pay to provide low-cost education to asking those who can afford to pay for the education at the real cost, or in some cases higher, so that we can provide aid to those who can't afford it. The cost of an education writ large across the University of Michigan is about $25,000 a year. At a tuition level of $15,000 a year, we lose $10,000 for every Michigan student we educate. On the other hand, we make $20,000 for every out-of-state student or international student we educate. That goes both to provide the missing subsidy that we no longer get from the state, but it also goes to provide those students who cannot afford to attend an institution like Michigan with the capacity to do it. In the 50 years I have been at Michigan, Michigan has continued to stand behind the fact that no Michigan student, state of Michigan student, will ever have to leave the university for financial reasons. And they do it in a lot of different ways. It's done very informally. President Slissel has introduced a new idea of free tuition for families making under $62,000 a year. But as he himself admits, it's just labeling, because they're already spending that money. They just don't call it free. But I think Sanders is correct that if you look at parts of Europe, particularly the Danish, Norway, and Sweden, they still have the idea of a free college education, but it comes at considerably higher tax, just like free healthcare, okay? And we have a different kind of a society which would resist that. I do think it's incumbent upon universities to be as efficient as they can, and sometimes I fear that we're not. But the reality is that if you can provide people with the wealth to purchase it, that's the best investment with the highest return they're ever going to make. And so the real key is to get the money from those people that can afford to pay a higher cost, you know, to use those resources in part to provide the opportunity. You want level opportunity. And it's a major restructuring that's happening really throughout the country. And it's beginning to happen to some degree in Europe as well. It's kind of a different form of tax, if you will. Yeah.
How do you think this, online education is going to affect a university like Michigan?
The experience thus far is that online learning right now is primarily being used by people who already have degrees and are using it for continuing education, for improving their skills. And so someone that says that they teach one of these massively open MOOCs, massively online open course, or whatever it is, if they have several thousand, there are only a small number of those that are trying to take it to actually learn or for credit. As we get more sophisticated, there may be other ways to approach learning. Carnegie Mellon has what's called an intelligent tutor model that is much more interactive with individual students, so it's not like television and so forth. But it's a way to distribute learning in a way, but I would also point out that in the 1950s and 60s, this university, through its televised extension program, had over 150,000 students taking courses through online television. Sunrise Semester is what it would call it. So it's not really new, okay? It's just, for some people, that's an effective way to learn. For most, learning is a social thing. And I always used to tell students that you're probably going to learn more out of the classroom through social interaction than you're going to learn in the classroom.
But you know, the thing is that learning online doesn't necessarily mean that you are devoid of the outside interaction.
That's right. That's right.
It's just that instead of sitting in a class with the professor, you are doing it anywhere that you are.
That's right.
And there's a worldwide movement for that.
But my sense is that place still has a value, okay? Students at a place like this have such a rich variety of social things that they can do, most of which do involve learning. They have to interact with people that are quite different. I used to be very concerned about having engineering move to the North Campus because I thought it might deprive our undergraduates with interaction with the Central Campus, the liberal arts, and so forth. But if we can just build that monorail that goes back and forth, but as I say, I think that different people learn in different ways, and I still think that location-based learning for most people is the most effective way to learn. Okay. Now that may change, but right now, I think there's probably more hype in at least the MOOC movement than substance in terms of challenging the contemporary way of a campus. It may not always be that way, but right now it still is. I better turn the floor back.
No, that's okay. We can have a couple more.
Okay, a couple more. Yes.
Well, I have heard you speak many times over the years, and I know that one.
I'm sorry.
No, I came to hear you again, so you don't have to be sorry. I know that one of the things that you often like to refer to is the speech, I believe, by President Angel, where he talked about the goals of the Michigan education being to be an uncommon education for
the
common man.
Man.
And I think that, and I like that phrase a lot, so it's stuck in my mind. But I think that one of the things that I feel, particularly as a faculty member still at the university, is that given all these changes that you have described very well, you know, in funding, in priorities, and so on, that part of what is the threat there, I think, is that we could become common education for the uncommon man.
Yes.
You know? And I, the only way that I personally can think, of course, but part of what one has to do is keep certain values always, you know, at the forefront of the decision-making process. But the other is, I think we need a lot more scholarships, you know, to make sure that that doesn't happen. And that, that's where many of us, I think, can contribute, you know, to actually make a contribution to the scholarship.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think you're correct. And if you look at the statistics, as we have, Michigan's increased enrollment by, what, about 6,000 students over the last 20 years. And most of those are students that can afford to pay private level tuition. That replaces our state support in part, but also provides the financial aid for others. But that there is a perception, I think, on the part of the common man, those that come from factory families and off the farms and so on, that there's no way I'll ever be able to afford the university. I thought that's one of the real purposes of this for free, is to kind of get the word out that yes, you can afford it. But there's another side of it. One of your colleagues wrote the book Paying for the Party.
Oh, yeah.
About the fact that we are attracting a lot of people from high-income families that may not have the same desire to learn because their futures are more secure than the kid that comes off the farm or is a first-generation college student. And they come for other things frequently. They come for the social life, fraternities. They come from athletics, the excitement, and so forth. And so I think we've got to pay attention to that. If you look at the statistics, Michigan, last time I checked, we usually measure how effective we are in responding to the common man by the fraction of our undergraduates that are Pell Grant eligible. They're eligible for the federal grant, federal scholarship. And we were down to about 10 to 12% two or three years ago. We're back up to about 15%. Michigan State's about 22 to 23%. University of California is well over 30%, approaching 40%. And the reason for that is really simple. The university, the master plan that created the University of California, the Cal State system, and so forth, also created something called the Cal Grants, which are state-funded, need-based financial aid. That combined with the possibility of a junior college as an articulated transition to four-year institutions, including the university. A third of the graduates of the University of California campuses are junior college graduates, which is kind of interesting. So they have a very robust state-based financial aid system, and the students know it. They know it's going to be there. Okay, Michigan ranks dead last, 50th in the country, in need-based financial aid. In fact, several years ago, the Republican legislature turned it in primarily, turned the need-based financial aid system into a subsidy of private colleges in the state. Think about our Secretary of Education when I say that. Okay. So we've got to get our act together. I mean, the fact that the University of California can have over 30% of its students that are Pell Grant eligible means they're doing something right in that state that we're not doing here. And that's, I think, going to be one of the great challenges the state's going to face, because we're not investing in the human talent that we need. Yes?
This is the last question I have. Yes. Thank you very much. But I would like to ask about the number of Nobel Prize.
Number what?
Nobel Prize.
Okay.
In science, literature, because if we talk
Nobel prizes.
Nobel Prize. Because I would like it to know, because, you know, excellence in research, by all standards, measured by number of people who achieve something. Because I would like it to know excellence, really.
Sure.
Like how to do university for Michelangelo, for the most bright people, you know, will be happy to be there. Not just common people. I'm always interested about really excellence.
A couple of comments. First of all, it has to be part with scale. Mm-hmm. We're a very large institution. We have activities in almost every academic program. There are only two other institutions that match us in how many programs are at that level. One's Harvard, one's Stanford. I'm sorry, three, Berkeley. Mm-hmm. the third. Okay, so we're achieving at a broad level excellence comparable to anyone. The other part of it has to do with, again, scale. Because of our size, what happens is we attract truly extraordinary young scholars. We pay a lot of attention to develop them. And about the time they get tenure, in comes Harvard or Stanford and offers them 2 to 3 times as much as we can. So, whereas at Harvard and Stanford, they don't develop them. They look at Michigan and Wisconsin and to some degree the University of California as the places that develop those. Anne has done studies with this study of 20,000 faculty, and particularly the faculty after the year 2000. She kind of tracks where they go. And the number, I think one time we went through it, there were about 600 of truly outstanding young faculty that get grabbed up when we leave. So the concern about how do we keep them here, should we invest enough to keep them here, that's a really important strategic question. The programs are just as strong, but the singular achievements like the Nobel Prize and so forth, or membership in the National Academy, which is an area that I worry about, it's kind of a question of university priority.
One more quick one, if we have one. Also, I don't smell the coffee. Would somebody check and make sure that the coffee maker is plugged in and that the plug is active? Usually we're smelling the coffee by this time. Sorry, Jim. Oh, good.
So university students from the K-12 system.
That's right.
Which seems to be under stress, if I can put it that way, at the moment. And with widely varying standards and, frankly, widely varying support for teachers who are trying to keep the standards high, and so many requirements for paperwork that the emphasis doesn't really seem to be preparing the kind of student who can really benefit from a higher education. So how can we help K-12?
The first problem is that Michigan's in a desperate situation. Philip Power, who was a past regent of the university, his policy magazine, The Bridge, he came out with an article on it the week before on the situation at K-12. By any measure, including those students presumably from wealthy families going to higher quality schools, Michigan is at the bottom of the states. You can blame a lot of it on the charter school movement and on our current Secretary of Education, but not all of it. It's a serious challenge. Maybe it's going to take, it has a lot to do with the political process right now. I think people understand what has to be done, but they don't understand how to handle the politics and achieve the support of the public in order to do it. When I served on the board that governs the National Academies, we were told time and time again that we understand clearly how learning occurs, but we don't have a clue how to apply that to learning systems the way we do it in this country right now. So, I don't think I will live long enough to solve that one.
I've actually taped this lecture tonight.
Oh. Yeah.